The following edition of The Fourth Estate contains offensive language. Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey. My producer today is Anthony Dockrell. And coming up, from media's Young Turks to this year's first media casualties, globally, BuzzFeed and Vice lay off close to 500 people combined, with around 11 journalists in Australia soon to be shown the door in Australia's BuzzFeed offices. Is this a sign our news media is really in bad shape? Or, apart from those losing their jobs, not a big deal? Clementine Ford, in-your-face columnist Clementine Ford has resigned from the newly merged Fairfax Nine entity, Nine Entertainment, after being cautioned for calling the PM an effing disgrace in a tweet. But wasn't she employed to be provocative, and or is the new Nine more prurient than the old Fairfax? The Press Council has censored the Daily Mail and 9.com.au for what it calls an unnecessary use of the word transgender in reporting a crime story, even though the woman involved openly identified as such. Did the website deserve to be censored, or is the Press Council interfering in reporting? And finally, some good news for the media, with the Edelman Trust survey showing a significant uptick in Australians' engagement with news and desire for facts. What can the media do to help this uptick along? To consider these questions and a lot more, we have, I think, one of the most senior and most exciting Fourth Estate panels ever assembled. Joanne Gray is the managing editor of the Australian Financial Review. She's held a plethora of senior reporting and editing roles, far too long a list for me to talk about now, but she's mainly worked at the Financial Review, and she's been the editor of Boss magazine, and she's been a correspondent in Washington. She's also worked for Bloomberg News in Switzerland, and has been the managing editor for Asia Money in Hong Kong. Thanks for coming, Jo.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Helen Trinker is also a managing editor. She's the managing editor of The Australian. She too has pretty well done everything pretty well everywhere. She set up Boss magazine. She now edits The Deal. She's been a correspondent out of London. She's worked for The West Australian, the AFR, the Sydney Morning Herald, and for the past, how long is it at the Oz?
This time around about 11 years.
11 years, yes. And she's also knocked off a few books, including a prize-winning biography of The Australian author Madeleine St. John, or St. John. And finally, our third guest is Lenore Taylor, the editor of The Guardian Australia, whose sharp and unflinching political reporting has graced the AFR, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Oz, and then The Guardian. Along the way, she's won a couple of Walkley Awards, a couple of Paul Lynham gongs for the Press Gallery Reporting of the Year, and authored a book called Shitstorm on the Rudd government's response to the GFC. She's on the phone. Hello, Lenore.
Hello, Peter.
Welcome, everybody. Before we get stuck into the questions I foreshadowed, I wanted to ask Helen and Joe a quick question about the Banking Royal Commission, and that is, the government has promised action on all 76 recommendations, and yet, of course, was not in favour of the commission, but neither were parts of the news media, including The Australian and the AFR. Quick question. Any regrets?
Look, no regrets. It's turned into an amazing news story, in fact, for us. I think what happened was, you know, we'd heard for many years about transgressions, and ASIC and APRA followed them up, and I guess we became a bit inured to the to that. And I think that what the Royal Commission has exposed is clearly a culture in the finance industry of definitely putting profits ahead of customers, and that's really hopefully going to be redressed. I'm not sure if it will be or not, but the Royal Commission, I think, was extraordinary because whilst we had heard of many of these cases, what they did, and Rowena Orr and her colleagues did, was really use them to harness emotion and to focus on bring to public attention the impact on individuals of these kinds of practices.
To tell human stories.
Exactly, which had enormous impact.
As is the job of journalists. What about the Australian? Well, I mean, the Oz was not in favour of the Royal Commission.
Just in terms of that, well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of organisations, obviously, and a lot of people who weren't sure whether it would actually potentially do more damage than good at that point, in the sense that this is a very disruptive, potentially disruptive exercise for the banking system and for the whole financial system generally. And, of course, I think we have seen some fallout, I suppose, from the Commission as well already in terms of things like, you know, credit, tightening of credit. A whole lot of things have come together, obviously, to make sort of, for example, credit for homes, you know, harder to get. I suppose my view about it was, and I editorialised myself in the deal about the fact that I had, you know, I personally had not had any problems with banks, right? So, like, there's a lot of us, and that's what I suppose is the end result, that mostly have fairly simple, straightforward exercises with our banks. We have fairly straightforward things with our superannuation. We are not on the receiving end. We haven't been, you know, burnt in a sense. And I also did sort of feel this argument about whether or not it was actually necessary was, as Joe has said, is that we knew that there had been scandals, and obviously some of our colleagues have done great work in exposing those, and they were out there. Many of them were being dealt with. Obviously, as everyone knows, a lot of the material that came before the Commission was necessarily sort of historical in a sense because of the stuff that had happened. Some of it had already been dealt with. Now, that's not to take away from the huge job it's done, and it's been a scarifying exercise for the banks, and in a sense it's kind of an incredible exercise for all of us looking on and seeing it, because we're seeing, in some ways, not just the banking system, but big business generally, you know, you could almost argue the whole kind of basis of capitalism sort of being exposed in the sense of saying, okay, this is what happens. You know, how do we manage this? No one's suggesting that we're not going to have, you know, banks operating like this. We're not going to sort of move away from the market, you know, all of those things. But how do you work this out? You know, and I think it's actually sort of a work in progress. I think it was, look, I just think nobody foresaw quite how it put an interesting way for a start that Hayne decided to conduct it. So it was about stories. And Joe used a really interesting word there because it's about emotion. And I'm not saying that's wrong either, but because it was about emotion, it's had a particular impact in various ways. You know, I personally sort of think that some of the people who appeared before the commission were asked to sort of give testimony about their behaviour and about the bank culture have been, some of them misread it, clearly. Yes. Some of them were caught up, particularly in the early days, on detail perhaps that, that's not, I'm not saying the commission was wrong, but you can just see the subtleties. It was not a forum for subtlety.
No, it was certainly not. Okay.
Anyway, so that's...
We'll move on. We might come back to this question, because really it goes to another of our topics, which is the question of trust, and very much goes to the trust, right? But anyway, look, let's talk about BuzzFeed and Vice. We've become almost numb to the announcements of journalists losing their jobs in so-called legacy media, but last week we heard about jobs being lost in, you know, what's called new startups, although they're not super new. BuzzFeed announcing over 250 jobs, about a dozen of those in Australia, and then Vice Media announcing it'll cut 10% of its workforce. I guess we all thought that these startups were going to, or were pointing the way to the future of journalism. What do you make of these cuts, Lenore?
I think it shows what's happened over the last couple of years in terms of how hard it is to survive on ad revenue alone, no matter what the scale of your venture. The impact probably of those changes that Facebook made to its algorithm, which really impacted companies that were trying to just sort of get viral content going. But I don't think it means that you can't successfully run a digital news organisation. I mean, many organisations are doing that behind a paywall, and Guardian Australia, we're doing that quite successfully with the reader revenue model, where we use both advertising revenue and revenue that readers give us voluntarily. We've just made a profit in Australia. We're about to break even globally, and traffic is going up. So I think there are different ways of making money, making a sustainable digital media business, but you need to, you know, read the market at the time, and those companies were set up when it was believed that you could just get there by advertising scale, and that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Yeah, no, it's a really, you make a great point. I mean, I think the other point that's been made about BuzzFeed and bring you two in on this is, you know, it wasn't that they were not making money. It's just that they were not making the amount of money that they thought were going to do, and so they sort of were running out of runway. Is, I mean, we all held up BuzzFeed in particular, but also Vice for being in a great transition company. They started off, you know, BuzzFeed making cat memes and cat lists and what have you, and then suddenly started doing what was could be purported, you know, was serious reporting. What do you make of this, Helen? Is it kind of reinforced the kind of the power you need through, I guess, being part of old media in a way?
Well, it's not so much, I don't think old media, I think Lenore's right. I think we have to think about getting our money, or the digital area has to get money from the readers, not from the advertisers. So it's just not going to happen in advertising. There's just, we all know the reason why. There's this massive inventory that's almost infinite. Who's going to pay much for that? So it is about a subscription model or some sort of payment model by the users, you know. And the problem with that is, look, I think, you know, I think it's, that one's just about to somebody said this, a matter of time, isn't it? The more that everyone gets used to that and the bigger your reach is. I mean, there's a lot of people in the world, and we're finding a lot of people with mobile phones, and we're finding a hell of a lot of people able to, you know, sort of pay at some level, maybe small amounts of money to access sites. I think there's also that what's been going on is a sort of a consolidation, because there's this rash of fabulous, everybody could, you know, they could get into digital, I suppose, and at varying levels. Because the bar is low.
Barriers are very low.
Yeah, the barriers are low. And so, but I do think, you know, I believed, like everybody about a decade ago, that you could do it through advertising. Eventually you'd get it through advertising. Eventually you'd get a model with, say, the legacy print and digital, in our case, like at News Corp.
Sort of a hybrid model.
And you get a hybrid model and you'd be able to make it work. Well, I think increasingly everyone gets it, that it's about subs. You
so,
know?
Yeah, about subs. So, okay, so, Joe, is there? Do you know, is there a limit to how many subs, subscriptions, that the AFR could have?
And what do you
share
mean by
with
that?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get to is how flexible is that model?
It's I don't think it's flexible, and I don't, you know, I mean, you know, we can't fiddle with the pricing in a way that sort of does it, you know, either or, you know, A-B testing to find out, you know, if we drop the, you know, the price, would we get the subscribers? I think, look, the focus has to be on creating content that people really, really value. And so it's much easier if you're in the, in a financial review situation where you're, you know, reporting on business, and people can actually take that information and use it to somehow to either make themselves wealthier or more successful, or their clients more successful, or they can win a deal. So they can actually use it to make money or somehow advance themselves. And I think, you know, that's a very narrow, I don't know how big that market is, but we're obviously wanting to test that.
Well, it's a central question though, isn't it?
But it's certainly a growing group of subscribers. I mean, we're actually growing at quite a fast clip.
The other big point here, I think, and I mean, Lenore might like to come in as well, so much about brand, you know, brand awareness. When you think about the big global opportunities there are now, and, you know, like New York Times, Washington Post, we know this story, Financial Times, you know, hugely small, terribly small circulation, Fin Times, actually in the UK. I mean, I was staggered years ago to find that it was something like 60,000 or 80,000 or something, very minor. But, of course, globally it's got one of the most brilliant brands. And to be honest, it opens, you know, digital opens up the possibility of global numbers in a massive amount. But, you know, how many Australian-based papers can have a global identity.
Yes.
Well, we're bringing Lenore back, Lenore. One other thing about BuzzFeed, of course, was that they had seemed to have cracked the magic code of sponsored content, or whatever they called it. Do you take any learnings from BuzzFeed's, you know, cutbacks on that? Because everyone's trying to dip their toe a little bit in this sort of sponsored content area.
Yes, and it's still important, but I think programmatic advertising is becoming increasingly important, and you know, as the other, your other two guests have said, content that readers value enough to pay you for it. And so I guess, you know, my experience is that having a model where readers aren't required to pay, you have to inspire them to pay. You have to do something they love enough that they get their credit card out and voluntarily give you some money when they don't have to, is quite a discipline. But, you know, it's edging up toward, it's towards sort of 40% of our revenue. We think it'll be half our revenue in the not too distant future.
Wow. That's, yeah. So you have to know your readers exceedingly well.
You really have to know your readers. You really have to, you know what subjects inspire them and what they like. And largely they like, you know, solid, old-fashioned, good news reporting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Joe?
Know your readers and know where, you know, try and find out where you're growing as well. You know, which segments are, you know, are growing and try and cater to that as well. It sounds very simple. It's not.
So what segments are growing for the Fin?
We've got a growing segment in the younger demographic, I guess you would say.
Younger rich people.
Well, no.
Aspirational.
You know, like people, this, you know, everyone wants to get ahead, you know, be sure. successful.
Want
everyone wants to, I mean, this was, you know, one of Helen's great insights back in 2000 when she created Boss Magazine, that, you know, people want to know how to build their careers. They want to know how to deal with people at work. They want to hear stories about, you know, people who have made it and their failures and their, you know, mishaps along the way and how they overcame them. So that sort
okay,
of thing.
But let's move on to someone who I guess was employed because she had an audience. She knew her audience. Namely Clementine Ford. But last week, the SMHNA, she resigned after being reprimanded by her bosses for calling the Prime Minister Scott Morrison an effing disgrace. But as I said, isn't that what she was supposed to do? I mean, chuck bombs? Lenore, you know you've got a few provocative columnists.
I do have a few provocative columnists.
So would you sack them if they called the Prime Minister an effing disgrace?
I wouldn't. I would certainly talk to them about it. I mean, I think there is a question about how your social media policy, which obviously all organisations have, applies to contributors who are so closely associated with your news brand that they're introduced as, you know, the SMHs, blah, or the Guardians, X.
Yep.
And, you know, calling the Prime Minister a fucking disgrace would certainly fall foul of our staff social media policy. So it would certainly, I think, warrant a conversation with a contributor who is closely associated with us. I must say, I think from reading that there's some dispute about the about exactly what went down in that the Herald seemed to be saying that they thought she just got some feedback on a column that she didn't like and she had interpreted it as editorial interference. Mm. I'm not, you know, I don't claim to know exactly what happened, but I do think that, you know, there's a live question as to how you have a social media policy for contributors.
And of course, and to you, Helen, and you, Joe, as well, you know, in a way, the social media world we live in, Twitter in particular, rewards that sort of, you know, stance. Mm. If you had a columnist who called the Prime Minister a bloody disgrace, would they deserve a reprimand for that?
Well, bloody's not as... Not
so is it the F word that we're really talking about?
I think the F word is... Okay. It's definitely the case of... I wouldn't like any of our people on social media to be talking... to be using bloody, to be honest. I think it's sort of it's unedifying. It is poor language anyway, apart from anything else. I think definitely the F word, you know, we in our social media policy, exactly the same as Lenore is saying it, you know, we say to people, you can't do it. You know, you can't use that language because you're representing us, you know.
That's right.
And we wouldn't really, to be honest, have in the print paper, I don't think we'd ever have have lots of columnists saying so-and-so, this politician or that is a disgrace.
Absolutely.
They might. But, I mean, we'd probably, as a sort of an editor of a daily, of a page, you know, the opinion page or something, I'd probably read that up and say, do you really need to say bloody, you know? Mm. I mean,
okay.
What's the point?
Well,
you know, think it's...
Well, columnist of The Australian, you have been warned.
Well, I mean, and there is also the question question of, you know, it wasn't just one thing, I
no,
don't think.
No, it was a...
It's an ongoing...
but she was employed to be provocative.
But I do think Lenore's right. She, you know, she was using the platform and it's, you know, it's a valuable place and we don't necessarily, and I haven't spoken to anyone at the Herald about this, but I think... You do have to be cautious about what goes on social media.
So before we leave Clementine Ford, can I ask, have you noticed any change in the culture of your new, you know, your new entity? Has it become more purient? Are you
absolutely not?
You're watching what you're saying at work.
No, I mean, no. There's been no change. There's not really no. I mean, no change that I can, explain. I haven't noticed any difference in the way we do our day-to-day jobs at all.
Okay, all right.
And also, Peter, Joe would be watching what she says at work all the time as a mature, sensible
And we never
person.
Use any of those words
no.
at work, ever,
no. It never
to
happens.
Anyone.
Not we in rec- the not rec- in news conference. No one ever says the word.
No, we recognise that the workplace is the place. No, I mean, I see it. So seriously, I think it's true. People... The levels of respect demanded in workplaces these days is probably much higher than it was when we all of us went into journalism 30 years ago.
Absolutely true. And given that we're all on, you know, there's a heavy deadline pressure every single day, people are under very intense pressure and still they behave very civilly, I think, towards each other on a regular basis.
Okay. It's the new civilised journalism we're working in. You're listening to The Fourth Estate across Australia on the Community Radio Network, coming to you from 2SER Studios in Sydney. Let's stay on controversial subjects. Let's talk about transgender. So the Daily Mail and 9.com.au have been censored by the Press Council for what it says, irrelevant use of that word in a story reporting that the sister of a prominent footballer had been charged over the death of her boyfriend, and I should add that the charges were later dropped. Just to read the headline in the Daily Mail, made for clickbait, of course, transgender sister, 31, of football star is charged with the manslaughter over the death of her boyfriend, 51, after domestic violence incident at house in Sydney's south. So I guess the question is, did the Press Council get it right? Helen?
Actually, I don't think they got it right. I think they were a bit half and half about it too, because I think they said it wasn't like I've forgotten the terminology already, but it wasn't a sort of a major problem, but it wasn't particularly relevant. I think this one was okay. I would say, first of all, it's tricky territory, all of these descriptions that we use, and I think it's completely the case that you have to think about it being relevant. I don't want to talk too much about this detail because this person was obviously completely cleared. The charges were dropped and whatever. But, I mean, the relevance here, I suppose, goes like this. Here is a person in a domestic violence issue, which is usually male on female, I suppose, in our culture mainly. And it's about strength. It's about physical power. And we have a very interesting story here where it's actually a woman
who used to be a man
killing allegedly doing something to their partner, and so I think that the fact that person is transgender is inherently interesting, to be honest, and it's relevant enough to pass the test for me. There's a lot of judgment calls all the time in journalism, and there's also another one that operates here, of course, is because that headline is incredibly interesting. story is just incredibly interesting.
Well, and it's made for clickbait.
Well, it's actually made for a story. I don't find anything wrong with that headline. It's too long.
Well, it's a daily.
But there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that headline, as far as I'm concerned, because it tells a really story, which is in itself. There's many components of it, and it was at the time obviously extremely sort of interesting. Now that's what we're in. We're in the business of interesting, you know, material, business of interesting news. Now, I completely understand you've got to sort of have judgment calls all the time about how far you go and what descriptors you use. I think this one, to me, it was okay. There's often times we have obviously changed our views on a lot of this many times in the last 50 years or so because we no longer refer to people of, by their colour. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that that has really changed. We made the point before we went on air about, you know, do we get offended about the mother of three? A whole stack of people never get offended by that. If you went to the press council and said, I've got no idea, but if you went and took a case of press council and said they should not have referred to the new CEO as being a mother of three, I'm not quite sure what the press council would say about
become
that.
It's a normative practice to do that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's normative. Lenore, what do you think?
I agree that it's a judgment call to use descriptors when they're relevant to the story. I probably think I would have made the judgment in this case that it wasn't relevant. We usually use trans or transgender when it's specifically relevant to the story. So trans people in the Church of England or transgender law rights or, you know, trans in the military. So it's like it's specifically an aspect of the story. It's essential to the story. It is a judgment call. In this case, I would probably err on the side of saying it's not relevant. But like Helen says, practice on these things changes over time. And, you know, I think certainly the complainants in this case are trying to change practice.
They certainly are, yes, and that's a whole another story. I mean, I guess to Helen's point, though, I'm interested in your view. I mean, she made the point, and I think it's a good one to make, is that perhaps it is relevant insofar as there's a power, there's a muscle element to it, as it were. The man who became a woman was probably stronger than a woman, you know, and so therefore maybe the violence aspect of it is amplified by the fact that the transgender person was formerly a man.
Yeah, it might be that's a bit of a long bar. I don't think it's essentially relevant to the story.
Okay. All right. Joe, what do you think?
Well, from the position of privilege of never having to write stories about or be editor, I was tending to Helen's opinion, but I think possibly Lenore is right. If it's not directly relevant, maybe it shouldn't be mentioned. And I mean, you know, at a certain point, are we going to get to the point where we even stop referring to gender? You know,
mother of two.
Yes, I mean, you see now some people are bringing their children up in an ungendered way, and you know, at some point we might even get to the point where we'd say, is gender even relevant to the story? So, which is ridiculous. Anyway, we'll get take us down that track.
But I think we're all agreeing that this is an evolving space.
Yes.
I mean, not related, but in a sense. But it, just to look at how, for instance, we now report suicide. Completely different than, say, even 10 years ago.
Yeah, and you can only applaud those sorts of changes. I think one of the I think it is extremely tricky, and I think, you know, at times you can make different decisions about it. I do think that this one, at risk of repeating myself, I think there were particular circumstances. Now, whether or not when that headline or that story was written, all of those things came into play, they might have been slightly unconscious, but it's sort of interesting. Mm. I think it is interesting in a domestic violence situation. Mm. You have a woman who used to be a man, and they're, you know.
I mean, I think we could.
Involved in that. You know.
Well, okay.
Domestic violence ultimately is just violence, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but, you know, it is violence.
Well, it's power imbalance, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Domestic violence?
Yeah, but say it's physical violence. Even if you're talking about physical violence, you know, there's unless you do not believe that that males are often absolutely physically stronger than females, and I happen to believe that that is, you know, the case that they are, not necessarily each male, but a lot of men of the same dimensions roughly would be a lot more physically powerful, have much more muscle strength. You know, so those are things that are interesting in a domestic violence context.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on.
That's very,
well, it's interesting, and I really like to get back to this subject some other time in the in the near future, because it's interesting to look at evolving practices in journalism or not.
Yeah.
So let's finish on a happier note, which is the 2018, this past year's Edelman Trust Barometer has been released. It was released, the Australian stuff was released today. I was on a panel about it. And it's shown that there's a small increase in movement and how people trust the media, but a large increase in engagement. And to quote the report, engagement with the news surged by 22 points. 40% not only consume news once a week or more, but they also routinely amplify it. But people are encountering roadblocks in their quest for facts, with 73% still worried about fake news being used as a weapon. Are we, let's start with you, Joe, are we surprised by this surge?
Well, I think we saw the start of it in the survey last year. People starting to go back to the established media brands. You know, I think we've seen, if anything, a lot of real news in the last year about how much fake news and how damaging fake news, how much fake news there is and how damaging it has been. And I think people have become, you know, over the last year, incredibly skeptical about social media and, you know, the Facebooks of the world. And I think, you know, obviously it's a fantastic thing for established brands who spend a lot of money employing professional journalists too.
Just on that difference between news media, traditional news media, and social media, I think the gap now is 35 points. So
I think in terms of the trust.
So it's an incredible gap. Although search is actually very close to traditional media. So this is all good news. How do we keep it going?
Well, I think we keep on doing what we've always done, really, which is to, in sort of traditional, I suppose, or legacy media, or, you know, serious media, to keep on trying to write really good stories, to try to, you know, get to the bottom of issues and to have the resources to do that, to sort of stick to those basics about trying to verify material, you know, to authenticate material. I mean, it's very interesting with the trust factor and the fake news factor. I interviewed a guy, the head of BBC World Service, this week for the media section of The Australian, Jamie Angus, and they are doing a huge campaign this year trying to get really looking at fake news video, you know, fake video.
Oh, yes.
And that's an area which I suppose I haven't been really thinking about a lot.
Deep fake or something?
And it's really, I mean, I think that's interesting because the capacity to manipulate, because the one thing, of course, that video has and is you sort of think, well, if it's happened, you know, you see it, you know. So, you know, it's not a journalist interpreting what's happened. I've seen this. And as we know, in all sorts of ways, that doesn't necessarily the case. But I think it's kind of interesting that that's a new frontier in some ways of fake news. But, yeah, no, it's great news for us. But I'm actually not that surprised, really, because I think the fact that we've got so much capacity, people can access news in so many ways, has actually meant that everybody's kind of much more engaged with information in a weird way. Some of it might be completely shonky, which is...
Well, and people are overloaded with information, so maybe they're coming back to trusted sources. Lenore, how are we going to keep this trust uptick going?
I think it's about the relationship we have with our readers, which has changed hugely in recent years. You know, we can engage with our readers below the line. We can respond when they ask in real time, when they ask questions about what we've done or why we've done it. We can take their, you know, like get tipped off or informed when we've made a mistake by readers sometimes. We know who they are. And I think the more transparent we are with readers and the more we engage with them, the more they'll trust us. So, I mean, that includes sort of showing you're working out sometimes, explaining the process of how you got a story. It involves being transparent if you make a mistake. It's a whole different relationship, but the more you engage with that relationship, I think the more those readers are going to trust you.
Well, we're going to wrap up now, but I do have one question for each of you, and it's the same question. We're heading into an election, as we all know, and there's been a lot of interest in government, what governments can do or should do or shouldn't do for news media, given that there is a widespread perception that news media, you know, needs a hand. We've had the Senate inquiry last year. We've had the ACCC inquiry into the social platforms. We had things like Judith Nielsen, though obviously not government, setting up a fund of $100 million. Is there, does the news media need if this incoming government, the new government, whichever colour it might be, in 2019, is there any one thing that it could do to help sustain news media? Maybe I'll start with you, Lenore.
I think making it easier for media companies to set up a DGS, a tax deductible fund for philanthropic grants for public interest journalism, would be hugely helpful. We actually do that now, but we have a workaround arrangement which isn't entirely scalable, and doing that would mean that we could look to philanthropy over this period while we're weathering the great disruption as a stabiliser. Mm-hmm. Tax offsets would be helpful. I'm drawn to things the government can do which are as far removed from any form of sort of direct government handouts that are difficult to politicise, because we all know that whatever the government, whenever it's media policy, you know, the debate gets politicised really quickly. And I think when the regional small publishers fund was set up, you know, that clearly happened. You know, I would like the government. I think there is a role for government at the moment, because public interest journalism is essential to a democracy. But I would like them to see them do something that just helps us make a sustainable business through the era of transition until we've figured out what the future looks like.
Okay, great, Helen. What do you want?
Well, look, in terms of sort of, you know, big policy decisions, I won't go there so much as thinking. I think what needs to happen is, I mean, I believe in public broadcasting. I believe in the private sector. Where I work, have worked, and I think a proper understanding of those entities and those business models, you know, and a mature understanding from, you know, government as much as anyone is sort of worthwhile. Just on a more practical level, I think the sooner that they get on, and this government gets on and appoints a chair for the ABC and then CEO, the better, because I think it's good. I think it's I personally think the ABC is a hugely important part of our news fabric, and it needs to just be allowed to get on with what they do, as we need to get on with what we do.
are you allowed to say that and work for Rupert?
To say that the ABC is hugely important. Yeah. Absolutely, of course. Yeah.
Okay. Although, I mean, you know, they are getting on and doing what they do anyway, and sometimes you wonder, well, how much do we need the board? I would...
That's fighting talk.
Sorry, I would agree with both of those comments. I mean, what I would say is that one of the biggest costs that we face is defamation payouts. I'm sure that, you know, the average person has no idea of the number of times we are sued for defamation and how much money we end up paying out to settle cases, even though our stories are correct. Mm. And in the public interest, it's very, very hard to prove that. And New South Wales is the defamation capital of the world. If you want to make money, build a pool, build a house, build a mansion, sue a media company in New South Wales. So it would be fantastic, I think, for public debate and, you know, just in the interests of democratic free speech if we had some reforms to our defamation laws.
And I think that goes across.
Yeah, it does go across. And there have been some sort of mega, you know, payouts that have been well canvassed and reported in the last year. And, you know, some of these are just, you know, they're sort of killing actually to, you know, the capacity to sort of operate. So, yes, I think things just, you have to be fair about this. You know, you need defamation laws that do protect you know, people to some extent. I mean, we have to have provisions anyway, so that if people are wrongly accused of things, etc., that there's redress. But I just think they're kind of getting a balance right, so that we can do what we have to do, which is in our jobs, which is to sort of try to uncover uncomfortable truths.
what we're here for. And on that note, I think we're going to leave this edition of the Fourth Estate. If I could applaud, which I can't, but I'd very much thank today's guests, Joanna Gray, from a managing editor of the AFR. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Helen Trinker, always wonderful to see you. Thank you so much. On the phone, Lenore Taylor from The Guardian. Thank you, Lenore.
Thank you.
Make sure you subscribe to The Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics and a few things in between anytime you like. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us On Facebook or Twitter, our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Peter Frey, and thank you so much for listening.